That was Confessions to My Unborn Daughter by Ambrose Akin-Mussory, featuring Walter Smith III on tenor sax, Gerald Clayton on piano, Harish Raghavan on bass, and Justin Brown on drums. It comes from When the Heart Emerges Glistening from 2010. Ambrose Akin-Mussory is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is part of the OSIRIS network. If you enjoy the show, I hope you'll consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to create more and better content, so become a subscriber if you can. Ambrose Akin-Mussory is a really fascinating trumpet player. He's made 5 studio albums and 1 live album, all but one of them for Blue Note. He's also recorded with Walter Smith III, with Archie Shepp, with Mary Halverson as part of her group Code Girl, with Tar Baby, with Roscoe Mitchell, and he's on Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly. His latest album, On the Tender Spot of Every Calloused Moment, is one of my favorite jazz records of 2020. I saw him perform the music at Winter Jazz Fest in January of this year, which, as you'll hear in our conversation, was actually something like a live rehearsal because they went into the studio and recorded the album the day after the show. That's just one of a whole range of subjects we talk about in this interview. I'm honestly not even sure how to preface it all. We discuss his style on the trumpet. We talk about each of his albums, including why he has occasionally taken several years off in between records. We talk about political engagement and how his own life impacts the music he makes, and a lot of other things. I really had a good time talking to him, and I hope you'll enjoy listening to our conversation. I'm going to play one more piece of music before I roll the interview. This is Tide of Hyacinth from On the Tender Spot of Every Calloused Moment, and it features Sam Harris on piano, along with Harish Raghavan and Justin Brown. So you can listen to that and sort of contemplate how much his style and the band's voice has evolved in 10 years. Because that's something else we touch on in the interview. And after that, you'll hear my conversation with Ambrose Akin-Mussory. Thank you. How's everything going?
Good. Somehow it's going good. Practicing. I have routines that allow me to get things done during these crazy times.
Are you on the West Coast right now?
Yeah, I live in Oakland, and so I've been here since all this started. I think the last time I left Oakland was the end of February.
Okay. Yeah, because your phone has an East Coast area code, so that's why I wasn't sure whether you're just like holing up with family and usually lived in New York or what the deal was.
Oh, no. I just kept my phone number from when I used to live there.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you grew up in Oakland, right?
I did. Yeah, born and raised in Oakland.
And what did your parents do?
What do you mean by do?
Like, what did they, you know, was anybody musical in your family? Like, what did your parents do? How were you raised, you know?
My mother's from Mississippi, from Drew, Mississippi, a very small town. And my father's from Lagos, Nigeria. I came up listening to, Bobby Bland and, B.B. King, and also King Sunny Ade and Fela Kuti. And my mother's side of the family, early in my life, were really into going to church. So I spent a lot of time in church with my grandmother and my mom. And that's where I started playing music. So in my early years, I would say, those were sort of the things that I did, just more dealing with the church and more black types of things.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's what they did. I don't know if we're just talking occupation.
Like what did they do? Were they, was your mom like a teacher, or what was her deal?
Yeah. I don't necessarily like talking about occupations, because there's a tendency to, like, my parents divorced when I was 3 or 4 years old.
Oh, that young. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And there's a tendency to have this, at least in the black community, there's this, how do I even say it without having to go too deep into it? There is this picture of a single black woman raising, a child, especially when he's male. And that wasn't really my experience. I had a beautiful childhood, and I know my father and have a relationship with him. So I usually avoid those types of conversations for that reason, because there are people who grew up in that way, but I definitely was not one of those.
Yeah, it's interesting. Do you know Shirley Teta, the guitarist from London?
Yeah, I do.
Because I interviewed her for Bandcamp, and, she had mentioned in a previous interview that she was raised in sort of a religious, household. And so I asked about that, and she's like, I want to be really clear that, that wasn't like some huge thing in terms of shaping my music. It was just like we went to church, like regular people, so don't like turn it into like a narrative. And so I totally get that.
Yes, exactly. But, it's funny. Yeah, I've known Shirley for a while. But, going to church, it had a huge impact on my music and who I am today, musically especially. I can remember the first time I heard Art Blakey. I heard Monin. And it just made sense to me, because it just sounded like gospel music being played on instruments, with a different rhythm.
Yeah.
And I think if I hadn't, been raised in a church, I wouldn't have heard it that way.
It's funny, I didn't think of your last name as being Nigerian. Like, I was going to ask about it, and then, but I wasn't, I wasn't sure, about the origins. I actually interviewed a bunch of Nigerian musicians over the years. I talked to King Sonny once, which was amazing.
What? Wow.
And I talked to Tony Allen a couple of years ago. I interviewed Orlando Julius also.
Oh, wow. Orlando Julius, man, you're in there. Not many people know about Orlando Julius.
Yeah. He made a record with this group out of London called the Heliocentrics. And so
I know that record.
Yeah. So I talked to him about that.
That's like 6-7 years ago?
Something like that. Yeah, I think it was 2014, yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
So,
Cool.
yeah. So,
That's
were your
great.
parents like politically active people, or did you become politically engaged later in life? Because I know that's something that kind of manifests a lot in your work. So.
I mean, first we have to talk about what that really means. I think all Black people are politically engaged, whether or not they want to be, you
Yeah,
know.
no, that's
And
definitely true.
yeah, I don't think we really have an option. But I think, you know, my mom being from Mississippi, one of the most racist, you know, the most racist state in America, especially when she was growing up, and then moving from that to the Bay Area in the 70s, you know, where you have the hippie movement and you have, you know, Black Panthers and all this stuff, you know, the residue sort of left over that from that. Yeah. So yeah, my mom was and is, you know, politically engaged, you know, but I think all Black people are.
So when did you said you like the church is kind of a big musical root for you. So like when did you pick up the trumpet? Was it and was it your first instrument?
I started, no, trumpet was actually not my first instrument. I started playing piano. So my grandmother had a piano in her house, and every time I would walk past it, it was on the way to the bathroom, and every time I walked past it, I would creep up the lid and put my hand inside of it and play notes. And I did that, you know, from the time I could walk. And so when I was around 2, 3, I started in church. I would try to get out of my mom's lap and run up to the piano. And a few times I was successful, and eventually a guy named Jonathan Green, he would put me on his lap, and I would bang on the piano in church. And you know, the beautiful thing about that experience is that they let me do it. So in the middle of church, you know, I would this 2-year-old would be banging on the piano. And from there, when I turned 3, my parents decided to put me into piano lessons. And I did that for a while, and then I went to Catholic school up into third grade. And during the days, I can't remember how many days a week, but I would say maybe 2 or 3, they would pull me out of class and I would take piano lessons in school. So piano was my first instrument. Later on, I went to public school, like in third, fourth grade. In the middle of third grade, I switched to public school. And there weren't any instruments in the school until you got into fifth grade. And so in fifth grade, I played drums. And my mom couldn't stand the sound of me banging on the walls and chipping the paint and the wood. The next year, she told me I had to pick a different instrument. And to rebel against that, I just said, okay, well, I'm going to pick trumpet. Because you know, I don't care, you're not letting me play drums, so I'm just going to pick this easy thing. It just has 3 buttons, so that's what I'm going to do. And so I picked trumpet, and I took it home and took it out of the case, and I played it. And from the first note, it sounds super corny, but from the first note, I fell in love with it. So I started playing trumpet in sixth grade.
Now this, I'm kind of curious about this because I don't like I there's a trumpet here, but I don't play it. Like, I mean, if I try really hard, I can get it to make the same noise twice, you know. But like, I'm curious about transitioning from piano to trumpet, or from any sort of chordal instrument to a non-chordal, you know, melody-oriented instrument. Do you have to think differently?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know. I don't know if you have to, but I can tell you that just from talking to many trumpet players over the years that some of them play piano, some of them don't, or some of them are coming from other instruments. There's something about playing, coming from an instrument that is visual, like the piano, like meaning you can see the notes and then you play the note, and then going to an instrument where you don't see the note. I think that has had a big influence on me. So, you know, so as soon as I started playing the trumpet, I also had this visual thing that came along with it that I think has helped some of the things that I've worked on conceptually later on in life.
I'm curious also about your actual style and voice on the horn because it doesn't sound like anybody else that I'm listening to right now. Like the way your notes kind of, especially like I saw you at Winter Jazz Fest, and I noticed this in particular, and also on the Live at the Vanguard record, the way your notes kind of slide off pitch and kind of drift away into this sound like the air coming out of a balloon, you know, and it seems to have a high degree of difficulty. So, I mean, can you explain what you, like it seems at the same time that it is a sort of loose sound, it feels like it would be really hard to achieve that effect. So can you explain what you do and how you do it?
No, I can't, but that's funny. I'm not trying to avoid the question or be difficult. I practice a lot. Partly because I feel I need to and I have to, but partly just out of respect for the music and the craft of this. I take this really serious, you know, and in my life I've had the opportunity to meet a lot of masters, to meet and know, you know, get to know a lot of masters, and you know, there's a certain reverence I have towards all of this, you know. So I practice a lot, so maybe that response is in reference to your statement of it being sounding difficult. Maybe it is difficult. But in terms of influences and things like that, I think a lot of people they ask me why I sound right the way I do, and I, you know, and a lot of people comment on not having heard anybody sound like that before. But to me, is, you know, I don't think that I'm doing anything so different from masters. I'm sort of just a compilation of a lot of influences, and maybe my references and my influences are maybe lesser known things these days, because I honestly feel people don't really check out the music as much as they did back in the day. You know, like I'm highly influenced by Charles Tolliver and Marcus Belgrave. You know, these people, these sort of unsung heroes, you know, the Joe Wilder, you know, the, you know, like really, really in there, type, you know, Don Cherry, you know, people say Don Cherry, but on top of the quote unquote normal influences that everybody has. But sometimes if I'm checking out somebody, I go really deep into them, and I really try to figure out how they think about things. And I also try to figure out how they're expressing. I'm also trying to hear the music in the social context, you know, meaning what was happening during that time. So I think all of that influences what comes out of my horn today in 2020. It's a lot of research and a lot of time put into it.
I mean, yeah, there's definitely a vocabulary, you know, that I can hear in you that I also hear in Bill Dixon, you know, mm-hmm. or even, like, if you listen to the Miles Plugged Nickelbox, he's doing some really wild shit, you know,
right.
that probably sounded completely wrong to half the audience in 1965, you know.
Right.
I'm just
playing, man. When I'm up there, I'm not thinking aesthetics, you know. I'm just playing. I'm just being a servant to the music. And again, that's something that everybody says, but like, I really do think, I know that is what I'm doing 100% of the time. I feel comfortable saying that everybody in my band is on the same page with that.
Yeah, the band, I'm curious about that as well, because you've had basically the same band since your second record, except for Walter, who's come in and out. Like, so how did you bring all these guys together?
Justin and I, it's probably the easiest one to talk about. We grew up together. You know, he's from the Bay Area. We went to high school together, and we actually met before he was in high school. I'm 2 years older than him, I believe. Yeah, 2 years older than him. So I think we met in my junior year, maybe, or my freshman year. There was a program here called YMP that was at UC Berkeley, Young Musician Program. We met there. Sam and I met in college. In my last year, I believe he was a freshman or something like that. I think I'm also 2 years older than him, 2 or 3 years older than him. And Harish and I met when I was in the Monk Institute in LA. So that was like maybe 15 years ago. So yeah, I've known I've known and played with Harish for 15 years, and I've known and played with Sam for 18 years or so, and I've known and played with Justin for, you know, more than 20-something years. And it's just, you know, they're just like-minded people. You know, they're committed to this path, and they're curious. And I think that's the one thing that we all share, is a curiosity about life and a curiosity about this music and how to express this curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. And also, you know, just as a music nerd, I always wondered what these bands that we all love so much would sound like if they stayed together for a long time, like a really long time. You know, we have MJQ and Keith Jarrett Trio, but, you know, what would it be like if the classic quartet of Train stayed together a long time, or, you know, the quintet with Miles's quintet with Herbie and Wayne stayed together for more than, you know, three, four years?
3-4 years, yeah, something like that.
Yeah. What would that sound like? Because we've been playing together as a band for 10 years now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a long time, you know? What would that sound like? So yeah, that's how all that came about, and my thinking behind it.
And Walter Smith was on your first three records, but then by the time of the live record, you were down to this quartet. So what was his reason for departing?
Oh, he didn't really depart. I didn't really see it like that. You know, I really see the quintet and the quartet as two different things, even though it has the same members. I mean, the type of music and the things we get into in the quartet is completely different from, you know, the quintet. And also, you know, I just wanted to play, I wanted to deal with the challenges of playing quartet, sonically, and also just the endurance that it takes to do that. Physical endurance. You know, we went to Japan. The first time we played quartet was in Japan, and we played in. And every night I was getting tired, and I was really thinking about how to address, you know, these 75 to 90 minutes. You know, how do I do this sonically? I was just up for the challenge of it. And I just started thinking about, in the history of improvised jazz music, whatever you want to call it, there's not too many trumpet quartets.
There's
some records. You know, you got the Book of Little, you got Blue Moods, Blue Mitchell, you have some Freddie things here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But really it's hard. Maybe Don Cherry played trio, you know, but quartet is trumpet quartet, and there's a reason for that. So you have KD, you know, Quiet Kenny.
And
Winton did one too. Yeah. So there's like, I mean, that was a stretch to name five or six, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's also that, you know, just the challenge of it, and also I really just like some of the corners that the quintet gets into. I mean, yeah, the quartet. Sorry.
Uh huh. There was a long stretch, by jazz standards, between your first and second Blue Note records. So it was like 4 years. What was going on in that interval? Because I know you did a bunch of other people's records, like popping up here and there,
man.
And you were in Archie Shepp's Attica Blues Orchestra. So what was, you know, tell me about that span of time.
Oh man, you're getting to it. Nobody's ever asked you that question on record. You know, I don't like attention. You know, just me as Ambrose Akinmusiri, I don't like it. I don't need it. It makes me uncomfortable. There's something about the stage that it doesn't make me uncomfortable, but I don't need it. Like I know people and I have friends that love being on stage, and once they get there, they're there. I don't dislike it, but I don't need it. Like if I didn't have all of these opportunities, which I'm very grateful for, I would think that I would be playing with the same people and playing the same music. And we were. That's another thing that should be noted. This band, we used to do jam sessions in Sam's bedroom. Just the four of us, and every now and then we'd invite somebody else. And Justin used to live with Gerald Clayton, and we would go to Gerald and Justin's house and play this quartet. So we were doing this before before any of the notoriety. But anyway, so yeah, after that first Blue Note record, the attention kind of got to me, and it made me feel a little, yeah, I don't know.
You didn't want to be like the hot young trumpet player?
I definitely didn't want that. So I kind of ran. You know, I ran from it, you know, so I moved to LA. I started teaching at USC. I said, okay, I'm going to do this other thing. I didn't give up on it, but I just said, oh, this doesn't feel right. This feels a little uncomfortable. And so, yeah, that's why it took me so long to come out with that next album. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of what that second album is about, you know, from the title and all of these things. So I dealt with some depression. I dealt with, you know, a lot of negative things, but I'm glad I went through it. And that second album is right before I came out of it. I feel like I was still in it for that second album. That's why it's, the mood of it is kind of, for me, when I listen to it, the mood of it is kind of dark and heavy. Mm. And same thing with the cover is kind of moody like that too, for those reasons.
Yeah. So the Archie Shepp thing, tell me a little bit about working on that project and the kind of rapport that you built with him, because he wrote the liner notes to your new record. So like, what have you learned from working with him?
Man, so much. It's not going to be possible for me to express all of the things. But I've been so fortunate to, like I said earlier in this interview, I've been so fortunate to be around so many masters in my lifetime. Before I moved to New York, I played and knew Billy Higgins, and I also played with Sonny Simmons. You know, I played a gig and got a lesson, if you could call it that, with Joe Henderson.
Wow.
I knew Herbie Lewis, you know. I played and hung out a lot with Donald Bailey. You know, this is all before I even got to New York. And I played and learned a lot from Steve Coleman and VJ Ayer. You know, so I've been around a lot of people who, you know, have helped me along the way. And so, you know, Archie Shepp was the next one who sort of helped me along the line. So yeah, he called me to do the Attica Blues thing, which is one of my favorite records. And I flew out and we did that. It was just an amazing experience. I caught the Holy Ghost in one of the performances. Like I was shaking, and yeah, it was a crazy experience. But just being around him and just seeing how serious he is. I mean, for that Attica Blues thing, man, we were rehearsing like 8 to 10 hours a day. You know, and Archie, you know, he was sitting right there, like ready to go. He was out working everybody in that band.
Yeah, no, he doesn't play around. He's like, you know, he's a major composer who's not really recognized as such, I don't think, to the degree that he should be.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I the thing that I have been that I've taken away from Archie is to just do your work unapologetically. You know, just, you know, speak it like it is and let it lay where it lays, you know, and if people come around to it, they come around to it. If they don't, okay, that's cool too. But you put the truth out there. And being around him was the first time I really started to understand the continuum of all of this. It's that was a great experience, and hopefully we did another concert after that. It was a Coltrane tribute, which one of my heaviest moments on the stage happened. It was with Billy Hart and Richard Davis and Jason Moran.
Nice.
And there was a moment I can't remember what song we were playing. We were playing a song. I took a solo, and then Archie started soloing. And then the music just started to feel like it was levitating, and I was just sitting there, you know. I got my goosebumps, and I had my eyes closed. And I looked over and looked over at Jason, and Jason stopped playing. And then it was so crazy that I felt like the music sort of lifted up. And Richard Davis and Mr. Richard Davis and Mr. Billy Hart and Mr. Archie Shepp, they went into this completely different zone. And after they were done, you could sort of feel them sort of come back down and allow us a space to re-enter into the music. And I was just like, shit, what was that? You know, so yeah, man, I'm really lucky and grateful to have had these opportunities. Now I'm, you know, playing with Roscoe Mitchell, and I'm working on a commission piece with Wadada Leo Smith.
Oh, nice. So,
yeah, no, I'm really grateful, you know, to have had these opportunities.
Yeah, what you're saying about Archie is the same thing that something Tyshawn Sorey said to me about that he learned from Anthony Braxton, and from listening to Anthony Braxton, is to just do whatever the fuck you're gonna do, and hopefully people will want to hear it, but do it anyway. You know.
There you go. There you go.
Just make the record and then try and get someone to listen to it, but get it done.
Are not even that part. Not even try to get somebody to listen to it. you just do the record, man. Then you do the next record, you know, and you know the things that you didn't cover in that record, and you cover in the next one. So for
the two tracks on Imagined Savior with the string quartet and flute, had you written much for strings before that? Like, did you study arranging with somebody in order to do that stuff? Like, how did that work?
When I was in the Monk Institute at USC, you were able to study with anybody who was pretty much anybody in LA who would teach you. And luckily at that time, Vince Mendoza and Billy Childs and Shelley Berg were at the school. So I studied with all of them in those 2 years. I studied with Vince for a year, and I studied with Billy Childs for a year, and I took like maybe 4 or 5 lessons with Shelley Berg. And I studied, we covered strings, and same thing with Billy. So I had studied strings before I wrote for them.
And the last track on that album is live. It's the only live track on the thing, I think. And it's like 17 minutes long. Where was that recorded?
Oh man, you really yeah, that was recorded at the Jazz Standard.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So, you know, so the funny thing about that is there is a whole live recording in between the first record and the second record that we recorded at the Standard, and I didn't feel comfortable releasing it. For all of the reasons that, you know, are related to, you know, your question about why it took so long to put on another record, just insecurities and attention things. Not really insecurities, just attention thing. So I just held on to that, and still I don't even know where it is now. But that track is from I think it was 3 days we recorded, but that run. And I just wanted to have something on there that reference that. And also a thing that maybe people haven't noticed is I always try to, with the last track or some track in the album, I try to point in the direction that I think I'm going. I really wanted to do a Vanguard record right after the second album, but Lorraine wasn't keen on that yet, so it didn't happen. She came around later, but it didn't work out for the third one.
Yeah, it's funny because I have to ask this just from a business standpoint. Doesn't the Vanguard actually charge more for a recording than a studio would have?
You mean for a day rate?
Yeah, like if you're going to record a live album at the Vanguard, they want a bunch of money, I thought. And so, you know,
it's not cheap. Sure. I don't know how it compares to a studio. I don't remember because I don't remember the exact numbers. I can tell you that it wasn't cheap. And the thing I love about the Vanguard is that they don't do it just for the money. So you can't just have a Vanguard record. Like, you know, especially when, not especially, but I know that for sure, when Lorraine was alive, she didn't care how much money you were going to spend on doing a Vanguard record. If she didn't like you, then you were not doing a Vanguard record. I can't remember how much it was, but yeah, it's not cheap.
And when you were doing those string, like, I guess it was multiple shows, probably, right? Were you playing only the new music, or were you mixing in tunes from the previous records, and, like, you know, or did you, like, tell people in advance what the deal was going to be? Like, was there a sign on the door saying, you know, we're making a live record, it's all new music, come on in if you want? Or, you know, how did it work?
Oh, no. It's a whole other book of music that never saw the light of day on a recording. I never recorded those tunes before or after that we recorded on that live CD. And no, people didn't know that we were making a live CD. I just felt like I was documenting it. And if it came out nice, then I would kind of release it over, you know. You know, and also another thing that happened, now that I'm thinking about it, another thing that happened between those two albums is Bruce Lundsvall sort of changed his position at Blue Note. You know, I was the last person that Bruce Lundsvall signed to Blue Note.
That's right, and then Don Was took over.
Don Was took over, and before that, before Don came on, there was a lot of, you know, murky stuff happening, and just weren't really sure where the label was going. You know, there was people being laid off, new people coming in, so there was a lot of other things going on. Now that I'm remembering it just because Don Was actually came to that recording. And I think that was the first or second time I had met him. He came in between those two albums, yeah.
Yeah. So I got to ask you about Origami Harvest from a couple of different angles. The first is, I mean, it was completely different from anything you'd done before. The only person that you kept from your regular band was Sam Harris. So was this like a different project that you'd been cooking up for a while? Sort of talk me through the creative process behind that record.
To me, that record makes a lot of sense. You know, a lot of people ask me that. I understand how it seems like this random thing that fell out of the sky. But like you said, I had been writing for strings on my albums. I'd been doing commissions that maybe weren't documented, but I had been doing a lot of things with strings. And, Here at home, I've been developing this band called Martin Lawrence, where it has Thomas Pridgen on drums and Mike Alberg, who's a keyboardist. He's on Derek Hodges' latest album for Blue Note, which is just organ and drums. So I already had this sound in my head, and so I just kind of pushed them together after thinking a lot about extremes. And the extremes that we experience in the world, you know, are things that seem polar opposite. And how, you know, as being an African American, and you have this, you have to deal with this question of whether or not to code switch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like what is this middle, you know, in between, you know, one side to from the other, from one polar to the other pole. So yeah, I was thinking a lot about that and how to represent it that sonically, and that's sort of how that Origami Harvest came about, you know, the music part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I've had conversations with some artists, like, you know, Casa Overall and people like that, where the question of hip hop comes up. Because, like, I'm 10 years older than you. I'm 48. So I remember a world before hip-hop, but I don't think you do, because hip-hop is almost 40 years old, you know, or maybe 40-some years old now. So it's like, you know, and Casa definitely does not know a musical world before hip-hop, you know, where it was, because to me it emerged as a new sound when I was, like, 11, 12 years old, you know. And so I'm curious how it filters into what you do. Is it just another element, or is it something that's, you know, dominant or, you know, because it doesn't show up that much in the work except for on that record. But I'm curious how it's, what part of your listening diet is it, and how does it work into the overall matrix of what you're doing?
Well, first we have to address what hip-hop is to me. It's not a genre of music that has a backbeat or that people rap over. It's a culture for me. So I am a part of the hip-hop culture. That's just what it is, you know, and the way I talk and the way I see the world and the way I experience the world. So I would argue that my music is that. And I would take it a step further and say that hip-hop is the most natural development of jazz. I mean, if you look at what was happening in the 70s, you know, if you can accept Weather Report or Headhunters as jazz, then you have to accept hip-hop as jazz. So to me, hip-hop is jazz. It's the most natural development of it. I'm not even making the argument of like hip hop and jazz are the same thing. I'm saying it is jazz. It is. I can hear Louis Armstrong and Kendrick Lamar. I really can. So it's kind of like what I was saying about gospel music and Art Blakey. There's black music. At the end of the day, is black music. Again, I would argue that I make black music, so therefore I make jazz, therefore I make hip hop, therefore my music is gospel. It's all those things. It's all one big tree, and I don't think that you can do one without the other. I guess you could rip a branch off a tree, you know, and then you know convince everybody that it's a tree, but you know it's just a branch. You know, black music is black music.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Yeah, I mean that's why you can hear so much, you know, church music in Albert Eiler, you know, or
there you go. You know, and when I go around teaching, you know, some people, you know, I'll play DMX and, you know, later Coltrane and dare someone to tell me that they can't hear how these things relate. You know, our Clifford Brown and Kendrick, you know. Or, you know, so yeah, I think jazz and hip hop are the same thing, and I think my music is hip hop because I am hip hop, and yeah, that would be my answer to that.
Yeah. This next question is tough because I've never even had to ask anybody a question like this, but 2 months after Origami Harvest came out, there were some very serious allegations made against Victor Vasquez, who's all over that record. How right. does that impact the way you look at the work you did together? Is that music tainted for you in some way, or what, you know, how did it impact you from that angle, from an artistic angle?
All I'll say about that is, A, I didn't know about any of it while we were doing the music. So we recorded the music. We played two gigs before we recorded it, and we recorded the music. So how that came about. We did two performances, and then everybody except for Victor went in the studio and recorded the music. And then after, for like a few months, I went in the studio and did a bunch of editing, and on the last couple of days of editing, Victor came in and did his stuff. So this album took maybe, I would say, 8 months to do. Mm-hmm. And during that whole time, I didn't know anything about any allegations, actually. So the question is related to like how to create during all that.
I'm curious how the album feels to you in retrospect, because the charges came out after the work was done and in the world. So
yeah, for me, the album doesn't feel any different for me. The art is the art. I can say that there probably is a reason that we haven't done any gigs with Victor since. I mean, we've toured the project, but Victor hasn't been a part of the project.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's related. Maybe that's related to that. But yeah, it's, and now in my head, Organic Harvest is a completely different thing from, you know, it was before Victor wasn't a part of it.
Mm.
I mean, I've thought about writing a whole other book of music. We're still playing the music, but I mean, it's, now we have Kokai, you know, who's completely different MC. And it just feels completely different.
Yeah, yeah. So I saw you, as I mentioned at the beginning, I saw you at Winter Jazz Fest this year, which was like one of the last gigs I saw this year. I mean, I think after that I went and saw Vijay and his trio at the Jazz Standard, and then that was like the last show I saw in 2020. But were you playing all new music that night? Was it all stuff off this new record?
At the Winter Jazz Festival, yeah. We actually went in the studio the next day.
Oh, okay. So it was like almost like a rehearsal for the studio.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. It was a pretty hard-hitting show, as I remember. I mean, Justin in particular was like, you know, was slamming the kit around.
Yeah, no, I mean, we always try to break some things here and there. we break some things, and then we sit down and we investigate the damage that's been done.
I've read that you said that the new record is kind of a sequel to the first Blue Note record. Can you expand on that at all?
Yeah. I mean, it's in the writing and in the visual. I mean, even in the cover. You know, you look at the cover. It's me standing there with my eyes closed. You know, the first record. You know, I'm clean shaven. You know, in a suit. This record, I have a hoodie on. You know, with my locks. And it's a close up. You know, the first record has all these colors coming out of me, but the cover of this record is black and white. The first record starts with a trumpet solo. This record starts with a trumpet solo, and there are other things. Also, this is just straight up. I mean, I guess with the exception of Jesus Diaz and Genevieve, this is an acoustic record, just, you know, with not too many tricks or overdubs or anything like that, just like the first record. Mm-hmm. So there are many things. I can go on and on. I mean, even in the sequencing, I tried to sequence it like the first record too. Yeah.
It's interesting too, because the bit with Jesus Diaz is like, it's a different type of religious music. You know?
Different from what?
In the sense of, like, you know, as opposed to what people would typically think of, like gospel or whatever, but it's, you know, it's religious music, but not from, you know, from that tradition, right? I mean, what is he, you know, what is he singing?
Oh, I can't really get into what he's singing, but I have to point out that this, you know, this is how I grew up. I grew up this, so that's why I was like, what do you mean different from what? And I'm like, oh yeah, you know, I'm Nigerian, you know, so I grew up with music that sounded like this in my home, and understanding it as a religious art. I think a better word is sacred.
Yeah, that's a better way of putting it. Yeah, but it's but to a lot of listeners, it's a different sacred tradition from their own. So, is all I'm saying with that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, I guess my last question is, you know, like we just said earlier, you know, your music is sharply socially engaged, and obviously you've worked with Archie, who's very much on that side. So I'm wondering if you can talk about what you see as the polemical value of your art, because I mean, the political side of jazz has been there since the beginning, but it often seems to be viewed as like an aberration or a surprise whenever an artist makes a statement that's relatively explicit, whether it's Ellington or Mingus or, you know, anybody. So, I mean, do you feel that it's a necessity creatively to represent that side of yourself in your art?
And this question is specifically for me. It's not a question of what an artist should do
No, I'm saying specifically for you. Like, you wouldn't feel comfortable making an album that was just like love ballads or something. You know, it feels like this is a necessary part of your creative identity.
Well, I honestly don't think that it would be honest. Yeah, it's just not a part of my experience. Yet, you know, it's all context, man. I'm raised by a woman from, you know, the most racist state in the most racist county. You know, my mom used to pick pecans on Fannie Lou Hamer's, you know, yard, out of her yard. You know, I have an uncle that knew Emmett Till, you know, and I'm born and raised in Oakland. You know, and my mentors were Black Panthers. You know, my first trumpet teacher was actually a Black Panther. So this is how I grew up, and that's my experience. I mean, even now living in Oakland, when I walk out, you know, it's hard to even explain, man. It's a whole other thing. So I don't have the, how do I say this without putting any judgment on it. My life just isn't that. My life isn't a bunch of love ballads.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my life is it's difficult. It's beautiful. It's beautifully complicated. And I think that if I am about expressing my life and expressing the world as Ambrose Akinmusri see it, then I have to find a way of expressing this complexity. And I would argue that every Black person has to deal with that. You know, every Black person living in America. You know, and if they're coming from an inner city like I came from, then even more so. If their skin is the color of mine, even more so. Like, I'm dark skinned, and I'm dark skinned, and I have locks. You know, and you know, I don't code switch. I could, but I don't. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a price to pay for that. So all that stuff is in my music. And then also there's the other side of, you know, there's a lot of people that look up to me. And that was another thing that I was dealing with after that first record, you know, the pressure of that. And it took me a long time to see the beauty in that. So, you know, if I have a platform and people are listening to what I'm going to say, I'm not going to just say, you know, there's a beautiful bird flying in the sky. I'll say that too, but I'm going to talk that shit. You know, I'm going to tell you the real thing. And if you want to hear about the beautiful bird flying in the sky, there's a thousand other people that are saying that. But if you want the truth, or my truth right now, then That's what it's going to be. And also, I speak for people. Again, I speak for people that look like me, people that are in North Oakland, and that's the way I play, you know. And I think there's another thing. I'm sort of getting off topic, but I try to represent my city, you know. And there's a certain thing about being from Oakland. There's a certain thing of just being so flamboyantly yourself. And not really giving a fuck about what people think or say, that I try to keep in my music. And that also relates to just being Black in America, you know, mm-hmm. and dealing with racism every day. It's like, yeah, we're racist, but we have a racist society, but I'm not going to let that affect who I am. And in fact, I'm going to be even more of myself in the face of that. So to get back to your initial question, yes, simple answer, yes, I have to do that because that's my truth. And, yeah, that, that part.
Yeah, because I do feel like as great as standards can be, like to make a record, you know, that's like All the Things You Are and, you know, all these other sort of, you know, tunes that people have recorded 100 times now, feels in a way like an act of retreat. In a certain way, you know, as beautiful a tune as it is, the meaning of it is not what it was in 1946 or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, look, I love playing standards. I really do. I love playing standards. And they're still very, you know, some of them are still very, very challenging for me. So it's not about me not liking standards or thinking that I can't express any of these things that I just talked about in a standard. It's just so far in my career, I haven't. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it has a lot to do with, like, what do you do from your platform? You know, and I tried to run from it, and I tried to deny that I had one for a long time. And, you know, now I can't. So it's important to me to talk about, you know, the injustices that Black people experience, the fear that I have walking around the United States and really a lot of places in the world. And that's why I call this last album a blues album.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's trying to express the beauty and the pain at the same time. You know, it's trying to express the resilience that is, to me, the most defining part of the blues is the resilience. And I think that's what all my records are trying to express.
Okay, that was my conversation with Ambrose Akinmusiri, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to improve the website and the show. So visit patreon.com/burningambulance and throw us $5 a month if you can. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.